Hey, George.
Hey, John, how you doing?
Pretty good. How are you?
Yeah, great. Summer's almost over.
Ah, don't say that.
Yeah, that's not great, but, you know.
Well, actually,
September's so much nicer than August, but, yeah. Then again, you have to go back to school.
Well, that's the thing, is I'm back into this this adolescent situation of, or young adult situation, I guess, of having summer vacation and then having to go back to serious work in the fall.
Yeah, got a little depressing, like in late August around Labor Day.
Yeah.
Like you couldn't really enjoy the Labor Day long weekend because you knew you were going back to school.
Well, at least students really get ready for school. I mean, I suppose some do.
Well, that's true. You just kind of show up with the books and pencils and rulers, and then start working then. But yes, as a teacher, you have to prepare lesson plans and things, I suppose.
That's right. I don't know if I've mentioned to you, I'm teaching a new class this semester. In fact, I'm teaching a class called it's the History of Science and Technology, and it's based on a text written by two of my favorite people at Stevens Institute, James McClellan and Harold Dorn, who are both historians of science and technology, and they wrote this great text, Science and Technology and World History. And so I'm reading it now, and it's a great book. It actually starts with the Paleolithic era and even tracks things like Stonehenge and some of these early attempts of our ancestors to try to discern patterns in the fluctuations of nature, that sort of thing. And then right up to nuclear power and nuclear bombs and all those sorts of wonderful things.
Wow, that's quite a sweep.
Yeah.
How many pages?
How long is this damn thing? I've got to finish this in the... it's almost 400 pages.
Yeah, wow, that's pretty quick overview. I'd like to... I'd like to look at that. I'm not familiar with that book, but it sounds good.
It's a really good book. I highly recommend it.
The Industrial Revolution's my favorite part of that story, I think.
Yeah? In a good way or a bad way?
Oh, good. Well... I appreciate the good things, but obviously there have been very many unexpected, I guess they were unexpected after effects as far as coal pollution and things like that. But it's just fascinating to read, you know, like Simon Newcomen and James Watt and inventing the steam engine and especially trying to explain the theory of the steam engine. And for a long time they were using steam engines with only a vague understanding really of how they worked.
Really?
And then there was this Frenchman, Sadi Carnot.
Sure.
Who came up with the concept of the Carnot cycle, and that basically you can think of a steam engine as taking advantage of heat falling downhill, quote unquote, like down a gradient, in the same way that water flowing down a hill is used to power a water turbine. And there's all kinds of really, really neat analogies there.
Was that before the concept of entropy had been invented?
It happened just around in the later years there, and it was, you know, a direct outgrowth of that with Carnot and then Kelvin, of course, and there's some great name I'm forgetting. Let me look this up. History of Entropy. I wrote about this in 10 Most Beautiful Experiments, and I've already forgotten.
Not Maxwell. Detailed. Maxwell's demon?
Maxwell, of course. That's exactly who I was trying to think of.
Yeah.
Yeah, Maxwell's demon. The little
guy
that sorts order from disorder and violates the second law of thermodynamics, except it turns out he really doesn't.
Well, yeah. So Maxwell's demon, as I recall, that linked thermodynamics and entropy and all those sorts of things to information in a way that still remains quite mysterious.
Yeah, information being either the equivalent or sometimes, as it's expressed, the inverse of entropy.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so yeah, that's it's something. Every time I think I finally understand it, you know, I think about it again and it kind of goes poof and dissipates.
Like quantum mechanics.
Like quantum mechanics. I think this is even trickier in some ways. Because with quantum mechanics, you can kind of just take Feynman's word that you can't understand it. The human brain didn't evolve to, you know, think about this subatomic world of probability, and not even standard probability. But with, yeah, the information entropy thing, that's really subtle.
Yeah. It has been linked to quantum mechanics, is linked to quantum mechanics, of course, and even to relativity. So I know there's some famous theorem by a guy named Bekenstein.
Yeah, Jacob Bekenstein, yeah. About black holes and entropy.
Yeah. And relating the model of the thermodynamic and relativistic model of black holes to the concept of information in some way that I don't really understand, but it has to do with...
You know who explains that really well?
Who's that?
You're not going to want to hear this. Leonard Susskind in his newest book.
Ah! Okay, that's fine.
No, he really... I read that and I... At least while I was reading the book, you know, I experienced one of those light bulbs popping on in your head and you really sort of get the connection and the significance of it.
Even the worst people have their good points. I should probably explain.
What is it with you and Susskind?
Well, the thing is, he was somebody I used to interview when I was at Scientific American, when I was trying to make sense of string theory and cosmology and all those sorts of things. And just recently, he's a proponent and maybe even originator of the term. Of landscape theory.
Yeah, right. That's basically what the book's about.
Yeah, so it's the idea that one of the implications of several different ideas in modern physics is that there may be many, many universes, an infinite number of universes out there with laws of physics quite unlike ours, and even though this is completely untestable, unverifiable, it's something that we should accept. And his rhetoric is just a little bit too over the top for my taste.
It's more metaphysics and physics, as it's giving you a new way to think about science, where the idea is to, in the same way you explain biological order through some kind of selection, some kind of random generation and selection process, that you do the same to explain the particular aspects of this universe. So it's just, it's kind of breaking the frame and thinking about science in a different way. But, some people take it as a real admission of defeat, that we'll never really understand, why the laws of the universe are this way. And I think we've talked about this, but David Gross, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist in Santa Barbara at the Kavli Institute, just hates the idea. So he and Susskind are just constantly at loggerheads over that.
Well, I think one of the points of disagreement is the anthropic principle. So
yeah,
Susskind
exactly.
invokes it to say why we find ourselves in this particular universe rather than one in which, let's say, there's no electromagnetism or no carbon.
Yeah,
it's a very
sophisticated kind of, I don't know if I'd say variation or advance or building upon the anthropic principle, but...
Well, another reason I'm irritated with Susskind is that we've crossed swords over, string theory, for example, which I love to mock, again, because of the testability problem. And I know all these anti-Popperians are going to come out of the woodwork in the comments section of Blogging Heads, as they always do, and accuse me of being horribly naive for insisting on falsifiability of...
The paparazzi, that's what Susskind calls them.
They call me one of the paparazzi. And
paparazzi.
I wear that mantle proudly, George.
Yeah.
But anyway...
Did you ever do one of your profiles on Susskind that...
No.
It wasn't in End of Science, but those profiles you used to do for Scientific American angered so many people.
No, I've never even met him, for example.
Yeah.
But one of the things that irritates me about him is that when I say something that he doesn't like, he basically says that I have no right to talk about anything in physics until I, for example, study string theory.
Oh, I see.
You know, get a PhD in physics, not just get a PhD in physics, but actually study, specialize in string theory. And I say that's like the Freudians who always said you cannot criticize psychoanalysis unless you have been psychoanalyzed and studied psychoanalysis for 10 years. And it's total anti-intellectual bullshit.
Yeah, it leads into turning your discipline into a cult if the idea is that the interested, motivated, intelligent outsider can't at least understand the essence of it and, you know, raise some questions about it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes.
I agree. Exactly. Well, yeah, that would have pissed me off, too. I've never interviewed Susskind. I just really, really liked his books.
Yeah, he's just, well, you know, he irritates a lot of people. I usually like
him. Yeah, that comes through in the book. I mean, yeah, and there's a great thing in the second book about when he used to hang out with Werner Erhard, you know, the guy that started S.
Really?
Yeah, a lot of those early string theorists were, you know, they had these meetings where they'd come to Erhard's mansion in San Francisco.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, you should at least read that part.
Yeah, well, that's more fodder for my cult accusations.
Yeah. Hey, I wanted to ask you about another class that you're teaching, which I didn't know about until I read it in your tagline on that piece you did in Slate recently.
Yeah.
About war.
Oh, my War and Human Nature class.
Yeah, I didn't know you were teaching. I mean, I knew, obviously, that this is a interest bordering on obsession with you, but I didn't know you were teaching a class called... You probably mentioned this before, and I'd just forgotten it. And then I read your article in Slate, which was really good.
Oh, thank you.
I liked how you went with your son, like, across the river from your house, where there happens to be the West Point Museum of War.
Yeah, that was fun. Well, okay, so the war class I started 3 years ago at Stevens Institute. It's called War and Human Nature, and it basically is an investigation into the question of whether... war is inevitable. So we get into different theories of war, and especially biological theories that war is embedded in our nature.
Right. So the same things we've been talking about the last couple of weeks.
That's right. Yeah. You know, so you brought up the War Museum. I'll just briefly describe this trip. I've been there a couple of times before, but I really wanted to go with my son, Mac, who is already a pretty good military historian and especially an expert on weapons. I mean, he just knows a phenomenal and sort of scary amount about about different kinds of guns and tanks and everything else. And they have a war museum, not surprisingly, over at West Point, the U.S. Military Academy, which is, I can practically see it out my window over here, right across the Hudson River. And they've got a section on basically the history of weapons. So you start with a stone blade that's about 10 inches long from the Paleolithic era. It's a little disappointing. They don't date the blade. Maybe they can't.
Probably not. Yeah.
But that's sort of an example of the first killing instrument. And then they walk you through bows and arrows and spears and pole axes and crossbows, and then the first firearms, blunderbusses, light machine guns, heavy machine guns, tanks, and then right up to Fat Man, which is the bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki. They actually have the shell casing, or a replica of the shell casing of
that was made here in New Mexico.
Yeah, right, it's Los Alamos.
Right, which I can see out my window.
Well, one of the things I didn't know, maybe you know this, because I know they've got a good museum at Los Alamos, too, is that Nagasaki was actually not the primary target for Fat Man.
Fat Man was Nagasaki?
Yes, Fat
Man was Little Boy. Little Boy.
Little Boy was Hiroshima.
Yeah.
And so the plane... which was, I forget the name of the plane, it was called the Bach or something, that was dropping Fat Man, was headed for some other industrial Japanese city, I can't remember the name, and it was covered with clouds.
Yeah.
And so they went to their secondary target,
Nagasaki. Yeah.
And the rest is history. But the War Museum at West Point had it had various aphorisms at the entrance and exit, and I jotted some of those down, and I actually quoted from this one passage in that Slate piece that you just mentioned in the lead, and I'll just give you the full quote here, because it's exactly the sort of attitude that I'm trying to confront in my writings and some of our discussions on Wagon Heads here. So it says here, man has engaged in organized warfare since at least the 4th millennium B.C. Actually, warfare goes back about 4,000 years before that, we know now. But they say 4th millennium B.C. Since that time, there has been a war of some sort in progress almost all the time through the present day. Even the presence of nuclear weapons has not ended man's willingness to go to war.
Unquestionably. That kind of contradicts some of the evidence that you've brought up in previous episodes here.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Unquestionably, war-making is an aspect of human nature which will continue as nations attempt to impose their will upon others.
Yeah.
Now, this is, it occurs to me that, okay, this is at West Point.
Self-serving ideology.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like a dentist, you know, like a dentistry museum saying there will always be cavities, or people will always have crooked teeth. I mean, obviously there's some wishful thinking there. But I just think that that statement is wrong and needs to be opposed. I'll just quote one other a misquote from the War Museum, and I'm trying. I want to track down one of the curators to point out the error. They quote. It's a famous quote. Only the dead have seen the end of war. It's often attributed to Plato. So the 2001. Excellent movie, Black Hawk Down, about this U.S. Humanitarian mission in Somalia that went really bad.
Yeah.
Starts off with that quote, only the dead have seen the end of war, attributed to Plato. The Imperial War Museum also has the same quote, and the War Museum at West Point has a quote. It's been traced to a speech given by MacArthur, his farewell address to West Point in 1962.
Uh-huh.
But nobody has found it in Plato's writings. It has been found in an essay by George Santayana in a collection of essays that was published in 1922. And he's overhearing some British soldiers. The war has just ended, and they're exulting that the war is over. And Santayana writes, yet the poor fellows think they are safe. They think the war is over. Only the dead have seen the end of war.
Oh.
So Santayana is the one responsible for this very grim, fatalistic quote. And I'm going to try to get the West Point War Museum to attribute it properly.
Yeah, they're all repeating the same distorted meme, I guess.
Yeah. So, it's a good quote, but it's wrong.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Seems like there was a quote that was attributed to Santayana that was in the last episode of Battlestar Galactica.
Is that right, really?
Yes. Coincidentally.
Oh, I'm glad. I was going to try to make that segue myself. I'm glad you did.
Yeah, I was trying to find it here.
I didn't know about that.
Yeah. And so anyway, I mean, you told me yesterday in an email that you finally finished the last episode of Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah,
and I was reading that review that you referred me to about which I hadn't thought too much about, the all the weird religious themes in the show.
Yeah, as you know, I became totally hooked on the series. I watched it on Netflix, and the ending was it was a little abrupt. But it was beautiful and heart-wrenching in some ways. So the basic story for those who aren't familiar with this is that humanity has created a race of robots, and the robots turn on their creators and there's this terrible war, and then the robots go off into space and leave humanity alone, but then they come back and they nuke the Earth, destroy almost everybody except for this small fleet of spaceships, in which some, about 50,000 humans, escape.
Including Edward J. Olmos.
Yeah, the Admiral is just fabulous. And Mary O'Donnell, I think her name is, who's a school teacher who becomes the president.
Yeah, the president.
And then they start off as enemies and become lovers by the end. That's one of the great plot lines.
Right.
But then the drama is basically about humans and then this race of robots that they've created who become the first robots look like robots, these big metal clanking things, but then they evolve into exact replicas of the humans, and they're still fighting, but then they start interacting and falling in love with each other, and all the relationships become really complicated, and both of them are looking for some place to call home. They're both searching for Earth. They even call it Earth.
Yeah.
And then finally, in this final episode, they find it, and it looks like Iowa or something.
It's just beautiful field. It's actually Africa, I think.
Is it Africa?
Yeah,
okay.
And grasslands and because at some point they're looking at a map. Well, yeah, and then they have those African looking tribe that they see in the distance, and
well, it's hunter gatherers who are
right
walking along and.
And
it turns out that they, do a scan of the hunter-gatherers, and they realize that they can, they're genetically compatible, and they can mate with them.
Yeah, oh, right. The doctor. What's his name? Gaius Baltar, yeah. Yeah, says, I see they'll make good breeding stock.
And that's a joke because he screws everything in sight for those.
Yeah, right. So... and then just shortly after that, I rewatched the episode last night because it had been so long since I'd seen it, and then I was struck by there's that scene where the Admiral's walking with his son Leo Dama, and then Leo Dama saying how we have to give up all of our technology, and I guess by implication all of our science, but we can talk about that, and then just start over with a blank slate. So it's just like, then they send all of their spaceships with this, damaged but very sophisticated technology, including all these important raw materials, into the sun and destroy them.
Yeah.
Like they want to start over as hunter-gatherers.
Right.
And I could totally not identify with that decision.
I couldn't either.
I mean, they could have done a lot of stuff with this equipment. And it really jump-started either our rise or our demise, but I guess that was the point.
Well, they still have the knowledge up here, but that was a very sort of strange, unexpected for me, Luddite conclusion.
It was foreshadowed from the beginning. There was the thing about how they were afraid to use any kind of computers, or especially wireless connections, because they might be infiltrated by the Cylon robots, so they use these funky analog telephones.
Yeah.
And actually, in recognition of that, I'm talking at the moment on a funky analog telephone.
Well, you love that old stuff.
Yeah.
You're not anti-technology. Yeah. You just love the old technology.
I like the old stuff the best, yeah. When they were just figuring out how to do things, and you could thoroughly understand it as an outsider. But anyway, so yeah, I thought that was a very weird decision. And then...
It was weird, but it was poignant.
Yeah.
In a way, I found it very moving. Just the idea of these people after this amazing space adventure that they'd been through, then they would spend the rest of their lives living in little sod huts or something.
Right.
Counting stars at night.
Yeah, and what's his name? The engineer, the chief.
Yeah.
Besides, he doesn't even want to hang out with any people at all. He just wants to go live by himself on an island and do some kind of Wittgensteinian thing.
Yeah, that doesn't appeal to me either.
No.
I guess.
Well, then what? The ending. I remembered how confused I was the first time I saw this last episode. Where then you get to the ending, so then you realize basically after all this journey, you know, they first thought they'd found Earth several episodes earlier, and it was like a burnt cinder. Mm-hmm. And now they've kind of randomly, although not randomly, but apparently through some kind of divine provenance, you know, involving punching numbers into a navigator that came from this vision that Starbuck and the scary little half Xylon girl has.
Yeah.
And with the melody and the colors and things. And then poof, they find themselves magically looking out over what's obviously the planet Earth, and then landing, you know, many, many eons before, you know, our present time when we're watching the show. So now we realize that, oh, you know, these are our ancient ancestors.
Yeah, was that okay? So that's
except that
was,
there's already humanoids on the planet.
Yeah.
Yeah. So again, this gets into this whole thing about if you run the clock of evolution backwards, is it inevitable that humanoid-like creatures will evolve independently, or was there some other thing that I missed, like the Cylons, you know, seeded the planet with our genes or something?
Well, you know, there was this theme running through the. The series, there was a religious saying that was repeated by a lot of the characters. All this has happened before, and it will happen again, which is
right,
the equivalent of
right.
their Bible. So it's this idea of eternal return, which I think we have actually talked about on this show before.
Oh, like Poincaré's eternal return.
So we are returning to the concept of eternal return.
Yeah, in a finite universe, everything that happens will... In a finite universe of infinite time, everything... It seems to me it would have to be a finite universe spatially, but infinite time, and then every possible cluster of matter would occur again.
Well, you know, this is one of the...
Or could that happen in an infinite universe in all dimensions?
Well, there are versions of this, I think... that apply to infinite time or infinite space. So, going back to landscape theory, there's a guy named Vilenkin.
Right.
Alexander Vilenkin, who was at Tufts, I think, who has talked about basically only slightly tweaked versions of our reality throughout this infinite multiverse.
Yeah.
Which is... It just seems like a silly kind of adolescent... idea to me. I mean, it's fun to play about, then, you know, forget it and concentrate on this reality right here because we got a lot of work to do here.
Yeah.
But did you notice there's a weird little sequence right at the end of that final episode where suddenly it jumps into the future 150,000 years?
Yeah, is it only 150,000 years? That's
yeah,
what I
that's
missed.
What
it's not, yeah, it's not, they don't arrive millennia before, but yeah, okay, so.
But George, think 150,000 years is actually much more time than you would need. You could go back 15,000 years from now, and things would look quite similar to what they showed
That's
at the
true.
Beginning of that episode with hunter-gatherers walking around with spears and so forth.
Yeah.
And think how far we've gone from being hunter-gatherers 10, 12,000 years ago to this.
Yeah, and then what were they
talking
doing
the
for those 135,000 years after they landed? God, it must have just been boring as hell.
I know.
Yeah. Well, then there's that thing in the very last. So they flash forward to what's now the present, when you know our present as TV viewers, and then they're showing the scene out in the street where two of the the Xylon, I don't know what they are. They're some kind of immaterial spirit-like creatures. Is that true?
Yeah, Gaius and that blonde babe,
yeah,
number six.
Yeah, the blonde,
or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, they all have different names, even though they look identical. Caprica?
Yeah, and then they're
like on a street corner in a city, and it looks very, like much like our world. And so it's like they've been monitoring us all the time. And then they're looking at a cover of National Geographic magazine.
Yeah.
And it's about the mitochondrial Eve.
Yes.
And then there's something implying that Eve is that creepy half Xylon girl that was always running around in the opera house and in Rosalind's dreams.
I thought she was cute, George.
So, well, she's cute, but kind of creepy, didn't you think?
Like, yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, there's something scary about her. But, yeah, so she's like the mother of us all was the implication.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, surely they did, you know, breed with the hunter-gatherers who were already there, so that seemed a little confusing.
Well, but then, so then remember there's that whole sequence showing all the robots?
Oh, right, yeah. Yeah.
And so it was looking back.
Like all these toy robots. And then they're playing Jimi Hendrix All Along the Watchtower, that theme.
Yeah.
So the
theme there, I thought again, it was all this has happened before and it will happen again. And I thought there was some reference. They had this very brief exchange. And as I recall, it was sort of the gist of it was, do you think it's going to happen again? Meaning the war. Meaning the creation of robots who then turn on the humans and the whole big drama, this kind of Manichaean thing. I don't know what it is, but a fight.
Yeah.
Breaking out a great battle between humans and their technological offspring.
So again, everything that's happened will happen, is happening, will happen again and again and again.
And especially war.
Yeah.
Or they said, maybe we'll break the cycle.
Yeah.
Maybe this time it won't happen that way. And we'll all love each other and be in harmony, George. Just like in...
well, I hope so. That's,
you know, Woodstock.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. Woodstock just came, the anniversary came and went, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what this reminded me of? This whole idea of the whether war is... Because I think this is a sort of powerful metaphysical idea.
Yeah.
That war is somehow necessary for to make life exciting.
Yeah.
Where you need this big conflict. It reminded me of a passage. This is in Infinite in All Directions by Freeman Dyson.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's speculating. Basically, it's kind of a rumination on why life is so fucking hard, on the problem of evil.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes up with an answer that he calls the principle of maximum diversity, which says that the laws of nature and the initial conditions are such as to make the universe as interesting as possible. As a result, life is possible, but not too easy. When things are dull, something turns up to challenge us and to stop us from settling into a rut. Examples of things which make life difficult include comet impacts, ice ages, weapons, plagues, nuclear fission, computers, sex, sin, and death. Not all challenges can be overcome, so we have tragedy.
Yeah.
In the end, we survive, but only by the skin of our teeth.
Wow. Wow. So that's getting pretty metaphysical, too.
Yeah, I think it's bullshit.
I mean, you can take another twist on that, and, you know, the thing from... I think it's from the Once and Future King, where everything that's not forbidden is compulsory. And Murray Gell-Mann adopted that phrase to describe the nature of particle physics, where if a particle reaction is allowed, is not disallowed by the laws of physics, like it won't violate conservation of energy or causality, then it will happen in an infinite universe. So again, it's kind of related to that idea of the Poincaré return and everything happening again and again. But I guess you could also relate it to the universe will be maximally interesting and diverse within the boundaries of physical law. Except, of course, if you believe in the landscape, and then the multiverse is not even bound that way.
It just seems to me that the idea of violence as being a necessary part of the drama of the universe is really, it's just stupid.
Well, maybe it just makes really good TV, so.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Except that people take it seriously. I think they actually make decisions about which foreign policy or leader to support based on these sorts of metaphysical ideas.
Yeah, the war is inevitable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, I that was an awesome series. It was really, the passage where Obama, the admiral, is
Obama, Osama.
Yeah, I know. I was getting mixed up. But he's got the
so
president.
So much hinges of a single consonant.
That's right. But he's really falling hard for that president. And
yeah.
their relationship is, you know, there's real chemistry there between those two actors. And she's dying of cancer. And they're finally in Earth. And he takes her up in his spaceship to give her a sense of just how beautiful it is. And it reminds me of that scene in the old movie Out of Africa where Robert Redford takes Meryl Streep in his little biplane, and they go sweeping over the herds of wildebeest and flamingos and all these beautiful African scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And so Bill Adama is taking the president, and he's describing to her what they're looking at, and saying that he sees a place in the distance that will make a wonderful spot for a cabin for the two of them. And he looks over, and,
oh, right.
and she's died, and it
yeah.
was just it was a very touching moment.
Yeah, that was quite wrenching.
Yeah,
she was a great character.
Yeah, she was.
Yeah.
There are a lot of good, strong female characters.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
I was just going to say, there are a lot of good, strong female characters in that series.
Yeah, yeah. Starbuck.
Yeah. Starbuck.
Hey, what do you think about some of these religious themes? Like, you know, the robot Cylons were monotheistic.
Yeah.
And the humans throughout are polytheistic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're always saying my gods, and
right.
You know, when they're not saying fracking this and fracking that,
right?
My gods. So that was kind of odd. So there's, I guess, one thing that really bothered me about the show was this reliance on inexplicable and indeed unexplained mystical stuff to move the plot along. I mean, it's such a cop-out. You know, it's like you don't have to really follow any of the normal rules of plot development or you know, Aristotle's rules of drama. You know, it's just something can just happen, and then you can attribute it to some weird, inexplicable spiritual force.
Yeah, I thought it was... I like the fact that certain supernatural phenomena were explained, had at least an attempt at a scientific explanation. So the Cylons keep getting resurrected, so you kill a Cylon and then a new version pops up in the mothership somewhere.
Yeah.
And so that was explained as there, you know, there's always the program that represents that person's psyche is stored somewhere, and so it's just re-embodied.
Yeah,
and that explains it. But yeah, but there was some other stuff like there was some other stuff that really wasn't explained. Like Starbuck was supposed to be some kind of supernatural being or an angel or whatever.
Yeah, right.
And that was pretty puzzling.
Yeah, that was annoying. Yeah, where she dies, she crash lands on the first burnt up Earth, and then and she finds her body there later and. Yeah, so that kind of stuff was really, really annoying. And then all this stuff with, you know, sacred scrolls and finding these markers in caves. I mean, that was all great while it was happening, but it was great because you think that, well, somewhere down the road, you know, a year or two from now, this is all going to come together and we're going to understand it. You know, like who planted these little signs, and there'll be a rational explanation, but
maybe
it's kind of unreasonable to expect.
Well, I thought there seemed to be some kind of hint at the very end again when those two sort of ethereal Cylon whatevers that are in this new city that is sprung from Earth. They're talking together, and there was a weird suggestion that they were that this was some kind of Matrix style virtual reality that they had invented and were overseeing, in which case they could bend the rules as much as they like.
Oh, I don't remember that.
I might have been reading that into it.
That'd be kind of interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, I was kind of hoping that they'd find out after they went back to the burnt-out first Earth that the humans had actually been produced in laboratories by the robot Cylons.
Oh, that would have been good.
That would have been a good twist. But then, of course, you'd have to explain where the robots came from. And I mean, there was this gist here for, you know, a series that could run for 20 years. And
yeah.
Too bad they had to wrap it up.
Right.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it's, you know, giving us all this philosophical stuff to think about.
Well, so getting back to more real-world issues, I read your great blog post on the Clunker program. So, So, give us your take on that? Because all the coverage I've seen of it has been really positive so far, except for the fact that they ran out of money.
Yeah, the cash for Clunkers. What was it? They put up $1 billion first, and so basically you can drive your Clunker into a dealer, and they run its numbers through a website, National Highway, whatever it is, NHSTA, is that what it is? And then they calculate, the difference in mileage, and you get money back from the government between $3,500 and $4,500. So,
uh-huh.
So I was kind of tempted to look into this because I drive a 1992 Jeep Cherokee, so it just turned 17, and I thought, well, you know, it'd be nice to get a new car. It gets about 20 miles to the gallon on the highway, but according to the U.S. government website, NHTSA.gov, it is rated at 17. So I was looking into what would happen if I traded it in and got a new Prius, which starts at 22,000, and, you know, more likely you're going to pay, you know, a few thousand more than that. So I did the arithmetic, and you get about 50 miles per gallon on the Prius. So
about 45 on mine.
You get how much?
I get 45, but I don't.
Okay, so you have a Prius. This makes the discussion even better.
Yeah.
They're great cars.
They're fabulous cars. But if you, they monitor your immediate mileage on this little screen.
Yeah.
And so it trains you how to drive in a certain way to maximize your mileage, so you just don't accelerate hard and you don't brake hard, and then you can easily get it over 50 miles a gallon. But if you don't pay any attention to that, you get 45, 46, which is still amazing.
Yeah, I've often thought that so much energy could be saved in the world if everyone who drove just had to learn just basic Newtonian physics.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that the fact that acceleration is very expensive. And if you see that the light's going to turn red, very likely before you get there and you're 3/4 of a block away, you should be coasting to a stop instead of, things like that. But anyway, so I did the arithmetic and I figured I don't drive that much. I figure about 8,000 miles a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm getting 20 miles a gallon. So I did the arithmetic and it turned out that if I got the, if I were only getting the 17 miles per gallon on the Cherokee, and I got a new Prius that was getting the ideal of 50, at $3 a gallon gas, which it's kind of creeping back toward, I would save $932 a year.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounded good. And then until you divide that into, after my $4,500 rebate, I'd probably still be paying on the order of $20,000 for the Prius. So that means it's like 22 years before it would pay off. And even with $4 gasoline, it's 16 years.
Yeah.
So, and again, you know, that'd be worth doing it because it's a responsible thing to do if I had someone, you know, that I wanted to give my old car to. But it turns out, and this was the real, as I described it, the real deal breaker, when you go look into the details of what they do to the cars. So they would take my Jeep, you know, which only has 126,000 miles on it. It has a perfectly good engine with good compression. The transmission works perfectly well. The entire drivetrain is in great, great shape. There's no rust anywhere on the car, which is one of the advantages of living in the Southwest.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd bring this perfectly good precision machine in, and the first thing they would do after it left the dealer is they'd drain the oil case, fill it with sodium silicate, fire up the engine again, and the sodium silicate turns to glass, freezes the engine, and destroys it. And then they destroy it. And then they take the whole car and they put it into one of these big car smashers. Well, just so they, so because I guess the basic concept of the program is they want to, well, mostly it's a you know way to you know pump money into the economy, but secondly it's to get these so-called gas guzzlers off the road. Mm-hmm. So you don't want the dealers just to sell them to someone else who has one of these low mileage vehicles. But that to me is just incredibly short-sighted and wasteful because, I mean, for one thing, the other factor, I didn't come up with any numbers, but if I were to trade in my Jeep for a Prius, I'd also have to figure out how much energy it took to manufacture a single Prius.
Yes.
You know, the steel that had to be produced from ore, you know, huge amounts of mining, plastic synthesis, glass has to be made from sand with all this heat, aluminum smelted from bauxite. Huge amounts of energy go into producing each car, so you'd have to factor that into how much energy you were saving, as opposed to keeping my 1992 Jeep running for another 4 or 5 years. And I bet if you did the arithmetic, you'd find that I'm saving more energy by continuing to nurse along this old car. But now it's going to be harder for people to do that because all these old used parts are no longer going to be available because they're all being destroyed by the dealers.
Yeah, that was a really interesting analysis. Actually, one of the big objections to Priuses that I've heard is that the you've got these huge batteries.
Yeah.
In the car.
That's not so environmentally nice.
Yeah, and that it's not clear how those are going to be recycled.
Yeah, lead acid. Is that what they are?
Yeah, I think that's sort of put off into the future and. And also, they're quite expensive if you need a replacement. I think I'm not sure what their life is. And every year, the batteries get better, so their life is extended.
Yeah.
But the early models, I think the batteries are not supposed to last that long. And so then you have the expense of a new battery for your car, and then also the problem of disposing of that battery in a safe way.
It's kind of another delayed problem is with these compact fluorescent lights that all have a little mercury in them.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, again, the disposal thing. Yeah, all these trade-offs you just have to take them into account, and it's just so simplistic to say that you should take your reliable old used car, have it completely junked and destroyed, even though despite all of the energy cost it took to produce it, destroy all these parts and then buy a new car that took even more energy to produce and then congratulate yourself on being green.
Well, you had a nice passage about, I don't know if it was groundbreaking or some sort of ceremony for a totally green neutral house in Santa Fe?
Yeah, it's called the Emerald Home, and it was getting a lot of hype here. And in fact, they even got the mayor to come and give his blessing, so the city's like endorsing the new Emerald Home, and it's described as a true net-zero home showcasing innovative design, materials, building systems, and renewable energy. And it will supposedly produce all of its own electricity, plus a little more, to spin the meter backwards. And, it harvests water, so it's doing all this great stuff. It's built partially from like rammed earth and recyclable or at least renewable materials. So it's being touted as being, the great sustainable house for Santa Fe's sustainable future. It's 4,125 square feet, which is almost double the footprint of an average size house in the United States. So my point was that any energy that's saved by doing all these admirable things is probably going to be dwarfed by the fact that you took double the amount of energy to produce it because you're insisting on having this ridiculously large, sprawling house.
Yeah.
It's also priced at $2.5 million. And yeah, good luck. I'll check back 6 months from now. But, this is happening all over where it's kind of used as an excuse. I mean, right now, the real estate market, there's such a glut of houses everywhere, including the Santa Fe market, and including million-dollar-plus houses that are rapidly becoming, you know, less than million-dollar houses. You know, there's just any number of, you know, huge years of supply of these houses languishing on the market. So somebody builds a 4,125-square-foot luxury house and then justifies it as sustainable by saying that, you know, it's green and using green materials and produces its own energy. But still, I mean, you know, the energy for construction and, you know, the responsible thing to do would be to find a house, and there's any number of them already built all over Santa Fe, including some real, real nice houses like on Canyon Road, and you put the same amount of money into it, less to buy, and then renovate it, and you'd be way off, you know, you'd be way ahead as far as shrinking your so-called carbon and energy footprint, but it's more fun to buy a new house.
Well, also, I mean, these are, that's a commercial product. So this is a company that is trying to sell more houses in a market where it's very difficult to sell houses. And so they're coming up with any sort of packaging that they can to try to appeal to people.
And then pretending like this isn't just a pure profit-driven, you know, I mean, maybe that, you know, they may very well have some idealistic undercurrents in their soul, but, you know, still basically they're trying to make money in a difficult housing market, as you say, and then, but then the guy, the builder, is quoted as saying something about, proud to be part of a community with a vision to guide its destiny toward a sustainable future. Well, if you want a sustainable future, first stop building houses, because there's plenty of them that are unoccupied right now that, need to be
George,
sold first.
We need more, journalists like you covering environmental issues and all the the green commercial industry.
Greenwashing is a term that I came across recently.
We need somebody to cut through all that bullshit because there is a tremendous
amount.
I think people are
doing that, but doesn't seem like they're doing it with cash for clunkers though.
Right.
There was an op-ed piece in the Washington Post that got into some of that objection of, you know, don't feel like you're necessarily being, you know, energy efficient because you're buying a new car. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, anyway, that was my... you know, when this really actually popped into my mind was about a week ago, and this is going to seem to undermine my whole argument, but I was driving... Yeah, I told you I was going lightning chasing.
Yes. Right.
Yeah, so I was driving. I left Santa Fe, and I was going up Interstate 25, and I passed Las Vegas, New Mexico, and I was about 30 miles north of there, which you're starting to get into just this very beautiful, open, and empty grasslands, and then my fuel pump went out on my trusty Jeep. And this was particularly aggravating because I had a new fuel pump put in just like a few days before because I knew my old one was getting weak. So they put in a new fuel pump, and it turns out they put in the defective one, and it went out stranding me on Sunday afternoon when I was supposed to meet the lightning chasers in Springer, New Mexico, a little north.
But, and were you thinking at that point that maybe you should have traded in that old piece of shit?
Yeah, maybe, but, you know, it all worked out. I called AAA, and it turned out they already had a wrecker going in that direction to pick up someone else who'd broken down. And they said, well, the driver can pick you up and give you a ride north to where you're meeting your lightning chasing crew, and then you give him the key, and then he'll come back after he takes this other people's car up to Trinidad, Colorado, and then he'll come back and take your car down to Las Vegas, New Mexico. So it all worked out, and the mechanic was really, you know, was really good mechanic, and said, you know, we're really sorry. They paid to have the car towed all the way back to Albuquerque and made it right. But anyway, that being a very clumsy transition into saying it was really cool riding around with these guys chasing lightning.
Did you find some?
Yeah, this is really storm season, like northeastern New Mexico and in the Oklahoma-Texas Panhandle area.
Mm-hmm.
So we were, I don't want to talk about this too much because I'm going to write an article about it, but we were, so this guy has this this great setup where, you know, the first thing I notice when I get in his car is he has a laptop mounted, you know, between the two seats, and he's got a Sprint internet connection so we can monitor weather radar, and then have a GPS screen, and then in back, he has this trailer with all these high-speed cameras, so he monitors the weather and tries to find, you know, tries to predict where the storms are moving, and then he heads out that way in this vehicle. So we're kind of clipping along toward Clayton, New Mexico, chasing the storm, and you know, see the lightning going, and then, but we didn't get close enough, and then it kind of dissipated. But you know, we caught several of them during that day and the next, and just saw some spectacular lightning flashes that they record on these high-speed cameras, and then you can look and see, you know, what's happening in slow motion.
Is it? It's like a. So they're actually making a movie.
Yeah, just making movies of them. Yeah, yeah. There's high-speed video cameras called Phantoms that take thousands of frames a second, and then when you look at them in slow motion, you can see how lightning starts. Is, you know, what they call. I think I said this the last time. The stepped leader that comes down from the sky. You know, kind of in steps, and then that ignites this huge return stroke, which just totally, you know, wipes out the whole image because it's so bright. And then often after that fades, there'll be another leader that will come straight down, like what they call a dart leader, and it'll go back and forth several times before it fades out, like a single lightning bolt.
Mm-hmm. God, I'd love to see a movie of one of those.
Oh, yeah, I can send you a clip.
Is the camera constructed? Are they basically predicting where a bolt will come and then aiming in that direction, or does it have some sort of mechanism where it's triggered by the initial flash and then records everything?
Yeah, so they'll have like three cameras in a row in the back of this trailer, and so you're parked by the side of some farm road, you know, in Kansas. Like one of the best storms we saw was north of Liberal, Kansas. Even saw a tornado form, which I'd never seen before. It was really...
Oh, God, I'm so envious. I've always wanted to see a tornado.
I'd never seen one before, all the time living in this area. I mean, they don't come on this side of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains. But so anyway, so yeah, they park the trailer, and then they have, you know, three cameras, you know, to get a pretty wide field of view, and then the cameras have some kind of optical sensor, so they're triggered by flashes. Mm-hmm. And then they'll record, you know, a few seconds of video onto one of the computers in the back of the trailer. So, yeah, so they were doing this, and, you know, we probably stopped, you know, half a dozen times in 2 days to record these storms. But then the storms would start getting closer to you, and there's like an electric field meter that measures how many kilovolts per meter the atmosphere is charged. And if it gets over like 4 or 5, you're not really supposed to be outside. And it was getting like to 20, so.
Oh, Jesus, really? I mean, you could be hit by lightning at that point.
Yeah. I asked him if he'd ever had any near misses, and he really hadn't because, you know, these people know lightning, so.
Yeah.
So, but this is, yeah, it was really a lot of fun, and, you know, I'd go into more detail, but I don't want to, you know, like when you write about something, you kind of want to keep it pent up in your brain, so.
Right.
So it comes out fresh.
Well, we've got something to look forward to. Hey, we're almost at an hour.
Hey, we did it.
Anyway, and I've got to, my son just turned 16, so...
hey, happy birthday.
I've got to take him to the motor vehicle department.
Oh, is it a full license?
Yes.
Not a learner's permit. He's already done that, probably.
Oh, no. It's a learner's permit. It's basically you get... The way he told me that you don't even... You take a written test. You don't take a driving test, and that means that he can drive with me in the car.
Oh, okay.
And so I'm supposed to be teaching him, or he can take lessons with somebody. So it's basically a learner's permit.
Yeah, I see. Well, that's good. Boy, that's an exciting moment when you finally get to drive.
A real rite of passage.
Yeah, and he has to learn how to do K-turns and parallel parking.
I think that's going to be a technology... built into this. I think there's some cars already have some sort of parallel parking.
I think they do, you just press
program.
A button and then they...
I'm proud of my own parallel parking, but I know it's a problem for some people.
Yeah, I'm good at it too, but it took many, many years.
Yes, me too.
And I can only do it with my Jeep. If I'm in a rental car, it's a disaster.
Well, okay,
well,
man.
John, yeah, it was good talking to you.
Yeah.
So you're about to head off on a beach vacation?
Yeah, taking my kids to Nantucket for about a week. But then I'm just about to start the series Lost on Netflix. So maybe in a few months we can talk about that.
That's
as well.
Great. I just started it recently.
All right.
We're so behind on these things. Yeah, I'm only up to like early part of season two.
Oh, I haven't even started. I think I get my first Netflix disc today.
Oh, that's great. Well, it definitely is holding my interest.
All right, good.
Okay, John, have a good vacation.
Thanks a lot, George. Talk to you soon.
Okay, bye.